we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Well, folks, it's been an incredible ride in terms of the news, the rapidity at which information has come out, the exposure that we've seen in this biopharmaceutical complex, and how tightly interwoven government agencies have been with private companies, including Twitter, other social media companies, almost certainly the major media, that's probably still yet to come out. And the news cycle is really buzzing. Well, welcome to Pulse. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough, and we're sitting in today for Malcolm, who's taking some time off for the holidays. So my guest in the studio today is John Leake. John, welcome to Pulse.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. It's a pleasure to be here.
John's a best-selling true crime author. He's been introduced to the Out Loud platform and audience in the past. But John, what are your views and your analysis on the late-breaking information regarding these Twitter files and FBI and CDC agents working directly with Twitter?
I think that we all sensed that in a constitutional republic, or purportedly a constitutional republic, that these social media platforms would be relatively free of government agencies, law enforcement agencies. I mean, I think we all sort of suspected, going back to the Homeland Security days, you know, 2001, the terrorist attacks, that there's probably some NSA, FBI, CIA monitoring, just in case there are violent or criminal actors that are going to incite violence or destruction. But I think we were all shocked to discover how anything deemed, could be deemed dangerous. Even a doctor like you citing peer-reviewed medical literature could be deemed as a hazard to public safety. And it's very, very concerning.
I've seen some of the emails that have been released in these document dumps. Great credit to America First Legal as one legal organization. We know that Elon Musk now is having Twitter voluntarily release various data dumps of emails. But some of the emails, one that caught my attention was from a Twitter employee, what I call now the Twitter censorship office. And they had captured a tweet from Martin Kulldorff, who's a former professor of epidemiology at Harvard and considered one of the most knowledgeable people on vaccines in the world. And Kulldorff's tweet was simply citing some efficacy data on the vaccines, which indicates that they weren't as effective as the initial stellar reports. And so the Twitter staffer had culled this out, and I think actually had sent it to a government staffer to say, hey, look at this one. I think this is a hot one. Can you imagine that it was down to people reading experts' messages and then trying to adjudicate them and vet them, either yay or nay, they go up on the platform or no, they don't?
To me, what all of this suggests is that this idea of pandemic response or countermeasures, I mean, just the word countermeasures, it really comes from military intelligence. I mean, the word itself, you talk about the enemy is going to make a move, the foreign clandestine service is going to try and gather information about this operation. So we have countermeasures, we have agents, we have trained personnel that can counter this. We see this kind of metaphor being used in the possibility of an infectious disease outbreak. So I think that what we're seeing is a kind of analog of military intelligence that has availed itself of this power over the U.S. citizenry. And anything pertaining to infectious disease outbreaks is deemed to be the equivalent of a foreign military threat.
But isn't it true, though, John, that in this world of this new world of bio warfare, bioterrorism, that our military has had an anthrax program, and there's been an anthrax vaccine as a countermeasure, that there's been a smallpox vaccine, in fact, a smallpox treatment called Tecovirimat, as countermeasures if somehow there was a smallpox attack. That isn't it true through DARPA, the research unit of the military, and BARDA, the biological threat unit of the NIH, that in a sense, our military has been preparing for this, and in fact, has tried it, right? So the military said, let's go ahead and pre-vaccinate for anthrax in the military, and let's pre-vaccinate for smallpox. Some of these vaccines have been tried in the military under emergency use authorization with no exceptions, no exemptions. The military just had to take these shots. So if you think about it that way, the origins of SARS-CoV-2 and the COVID-19 vaccines being military, it makes a lot of sense that, in fact, all these terms would be used, all the behaviors would be emulated, and that the only difference is the subjects of the inoculations, instead of being military soldiers who are conscripted, in a sense, or obligated to do this, now it's a free-thinking, previously free choosing population. So the difference is military, where the rights, and help me out with this, that maybe the rights of somebody in the military are not the same as the rights of somebody in a free living society. Is that true?
I think that this Department of Homeland Security, there is in the very name, this was founded in the wake of the September the 11th attacks. I think the concept is that it's no longer soldiers on a battlefield. It's the citizenry at home. The homeland could be attacked with guys flying aircraft into office buildings or sending anthrax spores by mail. We can debate about how much of this threat is exaggerated, perhaps even grossly exaggerated, but however much it's been exaggerated, it has been perceived by our military defense establishment as yet another opportunity to expand its portfolio of products, of expertise, of investment and personnel. And I get the feeling that there's a sort of, wouldn't it be great if we had a crisis? Because then we could at last deploy our resources, our expertise, instead of, you know, drinking coffee and eating donuts and sort of talking theory, now we actually have a war.
Well, you remember that documentary, 13 Days, where it's the president is John F. Kennedy and the attorney general, I think, is Bobby Kennedy, right? And the chief of staff is played by Kevin Costner. And it's the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, they're trying to see if they can negotiate here. It's Cuba, and it's getting pretty close to somebody hitting the button. And I remember so many of those scenes where the military brass were literally just push the button. Just let's exchange nuclear warheads right now. Let's go. These guys were juiced to go. And if it wasn't for John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, the chief of staff, there were some other critical players in the Cuban Missile Crisis that ultimately found a way to defuse it. And it's a classic documentary there. But what reminds me, the reason why I brought it up is how juiced these guys were. If the military people had their way, we would have actually had our first nuclear conflict back then if they had their way. I have a sense now, based on your analysis, that there are these biological warfare guys now that are in positions of power and they're ready to go. They're juiced. They are juiced. It's go time for vaccines. It's go time for more tests or more variants or another tabletop exercise.
Well, think if you'd studied cardiology all of those years and then no one ever got sick. You had no patients. I mean, so this is something that a lot of people say that I drone on too much about in a sort of professional historian way. But I really can't emphasize the point enough. I mean, our founding fathers, particularly James Madison, he expressly warned about an organized military establishment taking root in the Republic. Why? He said, because they will then become interested not in keeping out of military entanglements, of just protecting the homeland, having a good navy to patrol our shores, keeping the homeland safe. They will have an interest in getting involved in military conflicts, even if they don't serve the citizenry. So I think what Madison warned about ultimately culminated in what President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address of 61, in which it was a big warning. I mean, that probably made a lot of people unhappy that President Eisenhower expressly warned the American people, I'm concerned about the rise of the military-industrial complex getting too much power in pursuing its own interests, even if they don't represent the interests of the citizens. So I think this is what we're seeing.
You know, before we got into the current crisis, I remember years ago there used to be, you know, some snarky news reports about overpriced military equipment and no-bid contracts, and whether it was Lockheed Martin or the next defense contractor, and it'd be, you know, a $50 hammer, and it almost seemed as if there was this largesse that was going to these closely related, interwoven defense contractors. And the defense contractors, many of their board of directors are former generals and former military personnel, and people go through the military academy, and they are completely polished, and they've had their military career. They start their second career with the defense contractor. And so they're all, in a sense, together. They're friend together. And so this appropriations for the military budget, we always need a strong military. Everyone says that. And there are people, strong military means revenues to defense contractors. That's what strong military means.
And the analog continues, because a strong military, I mean, what is a strong military? A strong military is a really, really well-trained army with excellent communications abilities, excellent knowledge of the enemy, who could arrive at a fruitful political settlement to whatever troubled territory there is. Our military has immense destructive capacity, but we've seen in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, we can't ever quite seem to carry off a constructive political settlement. And I think there's an analog with what you experienced was, look, I'm here to treat patients. And it's not an expensive proposition. We treat them before they go to the hospital. We treat them with FDA-approved repurposed supplements. They don't really cost anything. The problem with the way that you are waging war is that there's no money in it.
And we have a situation where it seems like there's been a complete lapse in diplomacy. And I remember various peace accords, and heads of state would meet, and there would be a lot of fanfare and treaties, and things would be agreed upon between nations and what have you. What type of diplomacy have we seen in the last couple decades?
There doesn't seem the emphasis isn't really on diplomacy. It seems to be on some idea of maintaining superpower status and being able to dictate terms. And, you know, we have the military that will enable us to dictate these terms. But does it yield a better outcome for whatever the troubled region is, for the troubled region and for the safety of the American people? I think what we're seeing, Dr. McCullough, is a series of policy failures that each one just seems to be a matter of lurching from one crisis to the next. And as soon as the citizenry begins to feel like, well, now, wait a minute, like, what's going on with these wars abroad? Or what's going on with all of this Federal Reserve largesse to Wall Street? Or the moment the public starts to sort of awaken to the government and its friends really not doing anything constructive for us, we have another crisis and the subject has changed.
And we never seem to get follow-up on various things. You know, we heard about the withdrawal from Afghanistan and you know, some lives were lost and equipment was left. What happened? There never really was any follow-up. But what really happened in Afghanistan in the end? What really happened in Iraq or Kuwait in the end? It seems like there's no follow-up. Now, with SARS-CoV-2 and this worldwide crisis, we see the juxtaposition of the most amazing sets of behaviors. So ostensibly the same virus, the same communicability. You look at a country like Haiti, impoverished, people living in close proximity to one another, multi-generational households, no vaccines. They just kind of get through it with no hazmat suits, no fanfare. They just kind of manage. And yet you see in China now, China is a large pocket, presumably, of susceptibility to SARS-CoV-2. There, the newsreels are filled of all kinds of horror of people, workers in hazmat suits, people in body bags. And the American people are asking, can we trust what we see?
Yes, you do get the feeling that we're often in a sort of house of mirrors, and we don't know what we're seeing. I mean, we saw that in the early days of when SARS-CoV-2 made its way to the greater Milan area. We saw a lot of pictures of warehouses full of caskets and overloaded hospitals. But then if you take a closer look, you see a lot of this is footage from drowned refugee seekers in the Mediterranean and other, you know, major mass casualty events. So you just don't know. I mean, I remember this slick new hospital in Bergamo, which is an old suburb of Milan, and they had foreign news crews in the parking lot. It's overflowing, you know, the ICU. And then, you know, I did a little research on that hospital. It's true, it's a new hospital, a rather beautiful little hospital, but, I mean, it only has 40 ICU beds, or I think 47. Greater Milan has millions of people. I mean, that is not... So a lack of perspective.
Lack of perspective, and I think a lack of data. One of the very first papers I published on the crisis was early in 2020. I said, we need a national hospital census. 5,600 U.S. hospitals, 2,200 acute care hospitals. Sign an executive order where the hospitals each day have to report in and say, how many adjudicated real COVID patients do we have? To this day, we still don't have that. To this day. And the scoreboard that went up on CNN and all the major news stations that had positive cases, I knew where that came from. That came from the executive order that said every single positive test, no matter where it was obtained, in a community testing center, whether it was by Roche or Abbott or by Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, whether it was a hospital lab or not, the positive test result came in as a case. So you can imagine someone who went to a community testing center. You got COVID and you're pretty old. Well, you have to go to the hospital. First thing they do, get another test. Well, you've got, but this one could be negative. We'll get another one. Somebody could rack up four or five tests. There wasn't any reconciliation for it being the same person. And so it was just very sloppy data system. So the test positive data was never corrected for duplicate cases. People don't spell the names correctly. There's all kinds of birth dates are mixed up. So we had problems with duplicate cases. And the biggest problem we had is we didn't have adjudication for, did they really had COVID pneumonia? Did they have COVID respiratory? And we quickly learned that people could be positive many months after having the illness or be false positive and be in the hospital with an ankle sprain. And there the hospitals were incentivized to actually call it a COVID case.
Yeah, and I think that the testing itself became such a bonanza. I mean, that there again, the potential for a perverse incentive. I mean, do we really need all of these tests? I mean, are they really serving the citizenry at this point to be testing everybody all of the time? Well, it certainly served the people that were in the business of providing these tests.
Well, the tests are not treatment, certainly not preventive treatment. And there's been such a focus on U.S. dollars, countermeasure dollars going to vaccine companies. There hasn't been nearly the scrutiny that went to, you know, what about the money went for in vitro diagnostics? And, you know, all these tests done by community centers, laboratories, urgent care centers, you know, Americans know they didn't have to pay for them, that they were free. So the government paid for all of these. And I think the important points now to keep everybody updated is that the CDC has always said for the PCR to keep the cycle threshold low. Now, there are a variety of PCR tests. They measure four or more primers or little segments of genetic code for SARS-CoV-2, and they can be different segments. A common would be for open reading frame one, the spike protein, a nucleocapsid protein, and an envelope protein. That would be the common four primer setup. And so the PCR is looking for code out there that would light up these four primers to report a positive result. But as the machinery cycles again and cycles again and cycles again, it's more likely it will pick up genetic code from other organisms, even human genetic code, and say, oh, I found a few base pairs that match, and generate a false positive. So the CDC has always said, keep that cycle threshold less than 28, that you got to hit these primers in less than 28 spins at this test to be a positive. But what did Roche and Abbott and the other manufacturers do? They didn't pay any attention to the CDC. And to this day, if you were to get a PCR test, likely the cycle threshold would be 45, so likely to give a false positive test.
Yeah, so where, Dr. McCullough, are you seeing in terms of public awareness of what's going on? I mean, I suppose we have to be mindful of the fact that we're addressing America out loud. So our listeners now are very tuned into all of this. But do you generally see a shift, or are people becoming? Well, let me specifically ask: What do you think about this new regime at Twitter? Do you think it's really going to help?
Well, that's interesting. Well, just to finish up a few teaching points on the testing, the official word on the CDC is PCR thresholds less than 28 and no testing unless we're confronting an acutely sick person. I've always carried it a step further, saying, listen, their testing is so ubiquitously available and affordable that if we had a positive PCR, we'd want to confirm it with a positive antigen, or a positive antigen confirmed with a positive PCR. Why not do confirmatory testing like we do in HIV, since someone would have to self-quarantine for 5 days? It's an important diagnosis. And I still think today, worldwide, what I want our listeners to know is that in the U.S., our CDC says only test acutely sick people. And Dr. McCullough is saying confirmatory testing, low cycle threshold less than 28. If you were listening and trying to run a lab right now in Adelaide, Australia, that's what you'd want to do, and follow these, because we want a high positive predictive value, meaning that the probability of disease being present when the test is positive is high. That's what we want on an individual basis. So we want high positive predictive value, and we want a high negative predictive value, meaning when it's negative, they don't have the disease. Move on. What does the average person know or think out there? I think the average person now on testing is confronting the issue of, should they really take any more tests? You know, we have recent data suggesting in the United States, 94% of people have already had COVID now, 94%. We know that subsequent infections can happen, but they're characteristically mild. The question on the table is, should anybody ever get another test? So you've had COVID and you've recovered. You had a version of the McCullough protocol. Have you ever had another test since that time?
No. And I've, strangely enough, I've not had any cold, any kind of respiratory common cold symptoms since then. I mean, I'm going to touch wood right now. We're kind of getting into the season. But you quickly dosed me with a version of the McCullough Protocol, I no longer had any symptoms that you would identify as being SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 after 2 days, apart from fatigue. And I kind of had the blues. I remember thinking, you know, this sort of depressing kind of depression of spirits. And that probably lasted another 10 days. So 2 days of something that felt like symptoms and then 10 days of feeling tired. Is that typical, do you suppose?
That sounds typical, but you know, those Twitter executives may have filtered out your vignette and would have rather seen posted a fatal case. And I can tell you, I've seen so many Twitter postings where someone says, "Wow, I got COVID. It was really bad. You don't want to get it. Make sure you get vaxxed and boosted." Tons of Twitter postings like that. And chances are the vignette you just gave of yourself could have been filtered out.
Sure.
And so the people, and about a third of the world is on Twitter. We now, we have Getter, we have True Social, we have Facebook and Telegram. If there's consistently a method, an artificial intelligence way of method of making the problem look far more severe than what it is in every way, data coming across the TV set, all the public service messages, through social media, through billboards up on, what else would the public think outside the fact that this is an awful disease and that I for sure don't want it?
Yeah, and no qualifications, no distinctions, no word of risk stratification. I mean, to me, the greatest irony to emerge from this whole thing is the, holy grail of countermeasures, according to this complex that we're always going into battle with, it are these vaccines. I mean, that's the the end all and the be all. But SARS-CoV-2 presented little risk to healthy young people, but we're seeing now with the countermeasure, the beloved countermeasure, we're seeing, as you have pointed out on numerous occasions, elevated incidences of myocarditis in the young. So it's absolutely getting the whole thing wrong. I mean, 180 degrees wrong, which just, I still wake up in the morning sometimes and just think, how has this come about?
It's just, how could it have happened? Yeah. Well, we're going to pick up on this on the backside of Pulse, and we have some questions from our interested listeners. But you're listening to Pulse, and let's pause right here.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Let me tell you, this is an innovation. The Genesis Fogger uses HOCl. This is a form of hypochlorite. This is a powerful disinfectant that is tried and true. It's for sure kills SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus, but many other pathogens, including bacterial as well as mycofungal pathogens, enter the Genesis Fogger. It is a powerful mister. It's a dry mist, and it does cleanse the air. It does have a tremendous disinfectant capability for the room. It's used for industrial purposes and elsewhere, but now it's brought to you in your home to better defend you against SARS-CoV-2, the virus, COVID-19, as well as a host of other pathogens. So if you go to the promotional code and enter in OUTLOUD, you can receive a discount off of your first purchase. So go to the Genesis Fogger website and take a look at it. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
America Out Loud beats to the pulse of our nation. We know when you're angry, you're troubled, confused, glad, and thankful. We know you because we are you. Join us as we explore the most important issues of our time. We are America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back to Pulse. This is an opportunity for our listenership to ask some questions, but I do want to just bring into the conversation, since we are here, we're on set, and we're not in our homes, we're traveling, and in amongst us, one of our faithful travel companions has an upper respiratory tract illness. She's already said, listen, I'm sick. Okay. Now we're all on guard. John, I just handed you Cofix RX. Cofix RX, 1.5% povidone iodine plus carditginin, which is interesting. That is a substance that allows the povidone iodine to, in a sense, be somewhat resident up in the nasal passages and hopefully prevent acquisition of the virus. You know, viruses, we can't see them. We you know, it's been portrayed to us that there's a cloud of virus and we go through it. And chances are that we all have similar viruses in our nasal passages right now. And when we exceed a certain threshold, that's when we get clinically sick, particularly with an inoculum. So you just took a couple sniffs of Cofix RX and any side effects or any problems?
No, I mean, it's a slightly sharp sensation in the nose. I won't say that it's an immensely pleasant thing, but it completely negligible, slightly sharp feeling in the nose. But I used to get a lot of common colds. I mean, when I lived in Europe, and I don't know if it's the climate or... I frequently struggled with common colds. I've been using this product since you put me onto it a year ago, and the incidence of colds for me is almost non-existent at this point. I mean, I feel like I'm tempting the gods to make me sick because I've been around a lot of people with colds. But anyway, using it, and so far, so good.
Okay, John, we're going to pick up with some questions, and so you're going to take the role of Malcolm here. Hopefully your eyesight is good enough to see the first question that comes in, but go ahead and we'll tackle them rapid fire. You read them off and I'll respond to them.
A question from Eileen. My husband takes how do you pronounce that, Doc?
Dofetilide.
Dofetilide. Just came down with COVID again. Can he take ivermectin?
Important question. Dofetilide is used as an antiarrhythmic to suppress atrial fibrillation. That's the most common use for it. And the viral, antiviral class of drugs, there are some drug interactions I want people to be aware of. Hydroxychloroquine can prolong the QT interval and so can dofetilide. So hydroxychloroquine in this case is out. The use of Paxlovid, which includes ritonavir, and that can interfere with a whole variety of detoxification systems and has over 40 drug interactions, we would not want to risk Paxlovid and dofetilide. So we're landing on a very good choice here, ivermectin. Ivermectin is free of these drug interactions, And recently, as an update, I just took molnupiravir out of the McCullough protocol. It's very important. I just did this week. Molnupiravir is the Merck drug. It was the final antiviral in the class under EUA. A giant clinical trial called the Panoramic trial. Molnupiravir completely failed to reduce hospitalization and death. So that's one less drug. We have a very large clinical trial and we see no benefit, we go ahead and remove it from the protocol. Okay.
A question from Karen. I desire to know if there is any way to avoid having the COVID vaccine for my daughter-in-law, who is 7 months pregnant. She came to the U.S. on a fiancé visa in May of 2021 when she married my son. She's supposed to submit paperwork that requires her to have the COVID vaccine before January 30th, 2023, in order to legally remain here and get a green card. She does not want to risk harm to herself or her unborn baby. She already had COVID when she was 4 weeks pregnant. The only exception they offer to not get the vaccine is if she is allergic to eggs or yeast, if she has had a vaccine reaction in the past, or if she has a doctor's letter saying that a vaccine would be unsafe for her. She does not want the vaccine. What can she do?
Well, I think the listener, Karen, showing good judgment here. Remember that pregnant women were excluded from randomized trials of COVID-19 vaccination. So were people who had already had COVID. So she has two exclusionary criterion for not taking the vaccine. Now we have data published by Dr. James Thorpe showing a multifold increased risk for fetal loss. That would be a spontaneous abortion in the first trimester. And then stillbirth, once we get past 20 weeks, is considered a stillbirth, so the fetal wastage is high. But also infantile death, hemorrhage, a whole panoply of complications. There's not a single good outcome of a pregnant woman taking a COVID-19 vaccine. So in my view, it's contraindicated. I've published that with Ray Stricker in TrialSite News. That can be used as a reference. I think the single greatest relief that's new for Karen and her daughter is the wellness company. The wellness company is an alternative healthcare system. It's available as a cell phone app, and they will go through her case. They will give her a fair exemption from COVID-19 vaccination so she can deliver that baby and have a healthy baby naturally without exposing that baby to the foreign code for the spike protein.
A question from Harold. Can you point me to help resources for a young man who wants to join the Marines but does not wish to take the COVID-19 jab?
Oh, Harold, do I have good news for you. President Biden just signed the most recent round of military funding on the front side. John and I were talking about the, quote, strong military. Remember, the military appropriations have to be funded every year. And in this one, led by Senator Ron Johnson, as well as key Republicans in the House, Chip Roy and Louis Gohmert and others, they had in the package, the military doesn't get funded until they drop the vaccine mandates. And in fact, the vaccine mandates have now just been dropped. President Biden signed that appropriation, that funding. So I think at this point in time, I think we're in very good shape, Harold. I think this young man will not need to take the vaccine. Make sure that he contacts his recruiter and confirms that the vaccine mandates have been dropped.
A question from Deborah. I have a LBBB thrombophilia and Hashimoto's. My work is requiring that everyone receive the bivalent COVID vaccine now on top of the initial COVID vaccines. I've already received two initial Moderna vaccines and the booster, all of which have increased the inflammation in my body that took many months to resolve. I am looking for studies to submit to my work to fight this. I am very concerned about blood clots and my LBBB.
Deborah, out today in my Courageous Discourse Substack, I have the CDC data on nursing home staff. Think about nursing homes. That's the place where the real risk of COVID was. Staff gave it to nursing home patients. Nursing home patients got sick. Some of them died. There was clear transmission. Nursing homes was the highest risk COVID environment of all of them. Do you know what the current rate of nursing home staff taking boosters is, John? 10%. 10%. I can tell you the nursing home staff are not taking it. Deborah, I don't know what type of work you do, but if a nursing home worker doesn't need to take it, for sure you don't need to take it. A left bundle branch block is a proxy for the electrical conduction system in the heart being abnormal. A thrombophilia is a tendency to develop blood clots. Hashimoto's is already an inflammatory condition of the thyroid. So you have at least three conditions for which taking a vaccine and the cumulative toxicity, including the cardiac toxicity, systemic inflammation, and blood clots, all loom large in your case. So yes, you have a clear-cut case for exemption. I suggest if your doctor can't write a strong exemption for you that you consider the wellness company as an option to go ahead and do that for you. They'll do a good job. And it shouldn't be up to you to have to cite the data at this point in time. If you wanted to cite something, you could cite my U.S. Senate testimony on December 7th, 2022, where I stated that in the final analysis, all the vaccines should be pulled off the market. None of them are particularly safe. And when you have a predisposing condition like you do, several of them, you're even at higher risk. I'm in good company. Andrew Bridgeton from the UK, within a couple days, Member of Parliament, called for all the vaccines to be pulled off the market. We had similar calls from Member of Parliament Malcolm Roberts in Australia, calls across India. And on June 11th, 2022, the World Council for Health issued a pharmacovigilance report and called for all the vaccines to be pulled from the market. So I use the World Council for Health pharmacovigilance report. Go to World Council for Health website, download the report. I believe it's about 20 pages. You can append that to anything you submit to your employer.
Doc, there's a question from Victoria with a great deal of Greek in it. Would you read that?
Okay. Now, remember, I can't give personal medical advice on here, and Victoria has really loaded it up, but I'll read it off. I have a severe life-threatening reaction to the Pfizer COVID vaccine with my initial vaccine December 2020. It led to severe polyarthralgias, myalgias, what's called a serum sickness, and I had multiple subluxations, meaning the joints started to give way. I was advised by my fellow colleagues to get the second vaccine because I worked with immunocompromised patients. The second vaccine led to tongue swelling that was resistant to steroids, Benadryl and Pepcid. I had to take high-dose steroids for 2 months. 1 week after the second dose, I went to the ER, 8 times with shortness of breath, chest pain, and ongoing tachycardia. I was later hospitalized with the T-cell-mediated cytokine storm. And for 1.5 years, I've had POTS, the posterior orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, hypermobility, fatigue, and multiple subluxations. Hypermobility syndrome essentially became set in her case. Her research indicates she had 2 hot lots, meaning lots that were associated with higher serious adverse event rates. She's been treated with low-dose naltrexone and ascorbic acid, IM, B12 injections, and weekly physical therapy. Her COVID antibodies are still high. She's never contracted COVID that she's aware of. Her family got the COVID last month, and she never got it. My question is, if I were to get COVID, would I storm again? And if so, can I prevent the storm? Am I at risk for cardiovascular events? Is the spike protein still active and causing damage? My echo and EKG were normal, with the exception of tachycardia. This is the type of vignette. This is what I see in the office every day, John. Patients are just racked with multi-system manifestations of the vaccine. And now we have this confused overlay of SARS-CoV-2, the virus. And so there's many questions there. The one thing that we can do is we can sort out if she's had the virus. And the way to do that is to do antibody testing against the nucleocapsid. So first thing you could do, Victoria, is get a test for antibodies against the nucleocapsid. That would be a standard Roche or Abbott orthoclinical diagnostics. If you have antibodies against the nucleocapsid, that means you actually had COVID, the respiratory illness, when your family had it, and you're good. If your antibodies are high against the spike protein and spike protein only, it indicates that that's a residual effect of the vaccine. In your case, I would be very, very suspicious of an underlying genetic abnormality in collagen. And we find that individuals who have genetic defects in collagen, collagen 1 through 6, that invariably they seem to respond more poorly to the spike protein installation in the body. And the various forms of these collagen abnormalities can be, they can range from the most common one is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. There's another one called Loi-Dietz. There are related syndromes called Marfan's. Where other forms of collagen are affected, including various musculoskeletal abnormalities and Alport syndrome. But the bottom line is, in your case, and in general, when there are multi-system manifestations, the suggestion is for sure no more vaccines, number one. Number two, if you were to get COVID, seek early treatment, because my fear would be if you got a severe case already preloaded with the spike protein, you could end up with more severe complications. And so seek early multi-drug treatment like the McCullough protocol. And you're someone who, because of your risk status, you would want to be on some form of prophylaxis. Now, you know, the established forms of prophylaxis are hydroxychloroquine once a week, ivermectin orally once every 5 days, or using the nasal virucidal washes, Cofex RX, as one, but one could also use a clear, that's intranasal xylitol, you know, a homemade solution of povidone iodine or hydrogen peroxide or colloidal silver. You could do that. I think given the complexity and symptomatology of this type of case, probably once weekly hydroxychloroquine, which we relied on for a very long time, 200 milligrams twice a day, one day a week. You probably took that when you went to Africa for malaria prophylaxis.
Sure. Right? And I was wondering, what she describes, it does kind of bring to mind some sort of autoimmune response. I mean, could you say that this is in any way analogous to rheumatoid arthritis or lupus?
Not exactly. The you know, rheumatoid arthritis or lupus are syndromes that honestly are destructive to the body. If you've ever seen a person with rheumatoid arthritis, the what's called the metacarpal phalangeal joints, that is the knuckles, they just absolutely destroy, and you'll see the fingers start to fade outward and laterally. Rheumatoid arthritis can leave scarring in the chest, huge rheumatoid nodules behind the elbows. Really a devastating illness. Rheumatoid arthritis now has been revolutionized with the, what's considered the TNF blockers, Humira being the lead. Systemic lupus, a condition largely of young women, predominantly African-American, Hispanic, less commonly white. The malar rash, the red rash, having the hair fall out, fluid building up in the lining around the heart and in the chest, and then severe cases of lupus up in the brain, lupus cerebritis, lupus nephritis, renal failure, going on dialysis. No, we're not seeing that with the spike protein, but we are seeing autoimmunity of a different type. And the correct words were used here, polyarthritis, almost as if the joints ache. We're seeing clearly neuropathies, painful neuropathies, people feeling there's pins and needles on their hands. They can't sleep. It doesn't go away. It tends to be accentuated with each shot and then getting superimposed COVID. I have had enough experience with these, John, that I think that getting COVID on top of already having a vaccine injury syndrome is a bad thing. Sufficiently bad that I'm leaning towards prophylaxis, hydroxychloroquine, a wonderful choice once a week, and probably the intranasal approach. And hopefully, you know, doing this for months to a few years and avoiding recurrent episodes of SARS-CoV-2. We have time for one last question, and it comes from
John.
There we go.
Good name. Hello, Malcolm and Dr. McCullough. I have a statement and a question. I was forced to get the vax as my job was held over my head. I am an oil and gas safety professional. I work 14 on, 14 off in the Gulf of Mexico. So I very reluctantly took two Pfizer jabs in October and November of 2021. I am a little over a year now. I am a healthy 57-year-old. I supplement daily with D3, zinc, fish oil, vitamin C, and astaxanthin, and a multivitamin gummy I get from the wellness store. I lift light weights 3 times a week and a lot of walking and stair climbing when I golf at the house. Question: is there anything else I can do to minimize the effects of the sludge that I had to inject?
Well, I tell you what, it's, as I said, if nursing home workers aren't taking the vaccine, an offshore rigger, John, should not have to take the vaccine. No one should have to take the vaccine. I've been impressed with a product offered by the wellness company, and it's called Dr. Vanda Waters Detox Supplement. I've taken a careful look at it, and one of the key ingredients is nattokinase. Nattokinase is a discovery by the Japanese. It's a natural substance, and in one preclinical study, it's been the only thing we've seen that actually dissolves the spike protein within cells and doesn't seem to damage the cells or tissues. Now, it has not been advanced to clinical trials, but this is already a safe supplement that used on the counter, used over the counter for people with a variety of ailments. The Japanese, in many ways, far ahead of other cultures in some of these natural supplements. Dr. Vanda Waters has combined it with some other natural substances. Take a look at it. Go to twc.health and take a look at Dr. Vanda Waters Detox protocol and the supplement. Honestly, everything else being done in this case sounds great. We have no randomized trials. The government refuses to do any research in this area. People are searching for answers. I think the biggest thing is this patient, John, took the vaccine now more than a year ago and he's fine. And the majority of people who took the vaccines are fine. And what we say there is absolutely fantastic. No harm, no foul. Probably going to get out of this fine. Just don't take any more vaccines. Okay, well, I think we've come into the end of our time here on Pulse. John, what do you see coming up in the next few days or weeks? We've gotten the big news that the military will not have to have a vaccine mandate. You can see some of our questions tonight still have employers mandating the vaccine. We have looming California legislation that would force children to take the COVID-19 vaccines, yet we have other states writing legislation that would prohibit anybody to be forced into taking a vaccine. What do you see happening now? We're going to start the new year in January 2023. What do you think 2023 holds for us in this great controversy over the COVID-19 vaccines?
Well, I am telling all of my fellow researchers to, insofar as it's possible for them, examine the question, what is the incentivization for companies like this oil and gas company operating in the Gulf of Mexico? I doubt that they're holding on to this at this point just out of some executive boardroom fondness for vaccines. I suspect, and I don't have evidence, but I suspect there are still incentives in place. And so one of the things I'm going to be working on in the new year is gaining a better understanding of incentives. California seems to have some foundation money. The Gates Foundation seems to be very operative in California. We're just out giving some talks with an organization in California called PERC, Protection for the Education of Children. In California, we see this fanatical pursuit of the California State Legislature to keep imposing different variations of vaccine mandates. Why the zeal? Why the fanaticism? And I suspect that there are still incentives in place, and we just need to figure out what those are.
Are you saying we should follow the money?
I think we should follow the money. Who benefits?
And I think that is a good piece of advice to anybody who is in an organization that's still requesting, pushing, mandating COVID-19 vaccines. Where are the incentives? Who's making the decision and why? Remember the COVID Community Core Program in 2021, over $13 billion flowed from the White House and the Health and Human Services Department to a panoply of various recipients. And you know, one of the questions to be asked is, did that company or did that school receive any COVID Community Core money? And did it have strings attached? Were there FAQs that said you'll get this money, but you'll be participating in or be compliant with a mandated vaccine program? Another question to ask is, did this company have any relationship to Weber Shandwick? Weber Shandwick, the PR and marketing firm for Pfizer and Moderna, they had a corporate program called Plan VX. And Plan VX was basically corporate consulting by Weber Shandwick, the PR firm, to help companies come back from COVID. Well, I can tell you, I bet in the Plan VX playbook was a lot of social distancing, masking, fear, and you guessed it, taking COVID-19 vaccines. So besides the idea of looking at incentives and following the money, and I bet the money will be coming from both federal and NGO sources that can continue to promote the vaccines, we're maybe at the darkest point. Maybe the darkest point is past us now, and that we can start to become ever more positive. The pursuit of happiness can be restored, and can be basically, we can go back to normal. Is there any chance of that really happening?
Well, it seems like these events in recent days, your Twitter account being restored. I mean, we don't want to overstate one man's Twitter account, but Dr. McCullough has really been in the middle of all of this. The fact that Elon Musk has restored his Twitter account, the fact that the U.S. military has dropped the vaccine mandate. I mean, these are very positive developments. I think it's going to be critical that we not just, with our perennially short attention span, just forget about all of this. We do need to understand, do an audit on what exactly happened. You and I are working on another book about this so that the American people understand how this biomedical complex has perpetrated this, and let's see if we can try and avoid doing it again.
Well, John, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me on Pulse.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough.
You've been listening to Pulse. Always a beat ahead.